Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Our guest is returning friend Pierre Sabok to talk about his new book, Alien Invasion. And I'm really excited about this. Pierre is a pioneer in the field of scaphology, the study of text and mythology as it relates to ancient flying saucers, flying vessels, etc. And I thought that no one would be better to have right now to give us a historical perspective on what's going on in our skies than Pierre, who's been a very good friend to our show. So without any further ado, Pierre Sabok, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Right, thank you. It's great to be on. Thank you for inviting me again. So today we're going to be discussing my new book, Angelic Invasion. Basically, Angelic Invasion is looking at a topic which I refer to as new ufology. And new ufology is really the study or the deconstruction of symbolic language within the ufological tradition. It encompasses many different areas, such as scaphology, which we talked about, which is the study of these angelic boats or vessels within the angelic and classical tradition. In addition, new ufology also encompasses something which I refer to as exolinguistics, which is really the study of alien languages, but more specifically paralinguistics, which is this study of telepathy and the relationship between the spoken word and visual memory, but in terms of how this actually relates to telepathy. So this is sort of exolinguistics, and as I said, it encompasses paralinguistics. So yeah, it's a detailed book. It basically starts off with the scaphological tradition, and I'm just going to quickly review the scaphological tradition before we go into looking at the exolinguistics. So the scaphological tradition, well, the etymology of scaphology comes from scaph, which is a sailing vessel, and it's related to scapto, which is to dig out or to hollow out. So this is a small type of mooring vessel, and it's related really to the study of angelic sailors, and this is actually really important in relation to studying the ufological tradition, because the ufological tradition is really this ancient occult tradition which appertains to the scaphological tradition or to the angelic sailor. And so the angelic sailor is typically represented as an invading host or an invading army, and so we see that there's a correspondence between Malak, an angel, Malak, a sailor, Mekel, which is a vessel, and Maken, which is a type of ship. Now, Maken is related to the Greek etymology mak, which is to fight, but in the Semitic, Maken is a ship. Now, there's a diptych paronomasia on Maken, a ship. So this is an angelic vessel. As we said, Malak, an angel, Malak, a sailor, Mekel, a vessel, Maken, which is a ship or a vessel. But there's a wordplay on Maken with Makenes, which is a machine. And so these angelic boats, ships, or vessels are depicted as a type of mechanical vessel or a mechanical wheel specifically. In the scaphological tradition, they were typically depicted as flying shields. And again, within the scaphological tradition, the flying shield is equated with a number of important symbolic components. So the shield initially was a type of missile, and so we see that there's a connection between an emissary and a missile. And again, the shield is equated with a boat or a ship. So there's a correspondence, if you like, between Oplon, a shield, and Pleon, a boat or a ship. This relates to the seraphic tradition or the seraphic host, which are non-human angels, which in the ufological tradition obviously appertains to angels. And so we see that there's an etymological correspondence between the shield, which is Jannah, and a relationship with the jinn. Jinn, a serpent or worm. Jannah, to hide or to conceal, because the shield is a protective guard. But we see also that there's a relationship with flying shields in terms of deities as well. And so, for example, Theos, a god, is related to Thurios, which is a shield. And so again, the flying shield is symbolic of a ship. In the classical and Greek tradition, there's a correspondence with the harpies. Now, in the Greek, apoe literally means an abductor and is equated with erpeton, which is a reptile, which in this respect would be the seraphic host, opalon, a shield, and pleon, which is a boat or a ship. So within the scaphological tradition, typically the shield and boat are synonymous. And again, this also leads into divine bloodlines as well. So within the Semitic, Malach an angel is related to Melech a king in English kingship. So that's kind of the scaphological tradition and how it relates to, well, to new ufology. But as I said, new ufology is really an extension of looking at occult symbolism. And again, new ufology can look at occult symbolism within the modern ufological tradition, where scaphology looks at the symbology within the classical and religious tradition. So the first section of my book, which is the prologue, is titled Scaphology to New Ufology. And so new ufology is really looking at these symbolic chains. I refer to this as, again, this is interlinking within memory in terms of abduction. So this links to the three modes of representation. And I'm kind of very interested in looking at memory and how memory appertains to the ufological tradition, and particularly the idea of switched memories. So I refer to them as switched memories. Typically they're referred to as screen memories, but I think switched memories is a much more closer or accurate representation of memory, which is found within the narrative, within folklore narratives, and also within the ufological tradition as well. And so in order to understand how memory can be switched, it's really important to understand language and understand our language and memory are very closely interconnected. In order to do this, I've developed a system which is the three modes of representation, and this is really looking deeply into work which I've already done into occult symbolism, which was really found in my first book, The Murder of Reality. So a lot of the ideas in terms of symbology and how this relates to etymology and the representation of symbolic language, those ideas kind of developed, and I've developed these and written these up in Angelic Invasion. So in terms of the three modes of representation, basically you have the first mode of representation. This is morphology, and morphology in terms of memory, the memory categorizes language morphologically. So to give you a quick understanding, stick, stack and stock are all interrelated concepts. And therefore, what you find within memory is that the closer the etymology, the closer the word parameter or the close relationship between the actual word. Now, the second mode of representation is itinerary. An itinerary is a map of meaning. And this is really kind of a schemata, or in terms of how words are classified. And this is important within ufological, you know, ufological narratives, because people, when they're reporting what they're seeing, the memories are not necessarily accurate. Sometimes we're seeing these switch or screen memories. And so trying to understand how memory is categorized is really important, I think, basically to understand what is happening within happening psychologically. And so, as we said, the second mode of representation is itinerary or classification. So to give you an example, a car would be typically classed as a vehicle and could be represented with a motorbike, or a computer could be closely grouped together with a mouse or a monitor. And so this is how the mind categorizes. Now, the combination of the first and the second mode of representation is the third mode of representation, which is the tertiary mode or tertiary representation. And this is a combination of the two, which gives us symbolic language. In the occult tradition, this would also give us private discourse or ideoglossolalia, which is this private speech. So that's basically where symbolic language arises from, and is closely related to symbolic or syntenic symbolism. And in fact, I argue that the structuring of the subconscious mind is created through these syntenic strings, or these word relationships. So to give you an example, ride would be related etymologically to raid, brick would be related to block. So these are kind of very simplistic syntenic strings within the representation. Within a single language, the syntenic string is referred to as a syntenic string. But what we find is that there's a universal symbolism. And I know I'm kind of mumbling on here, but there is a relevance to this in terms of the holographic nature of reality. So with these syntenic strings, we see that they're universal and they're found in multiple languages. This is referred to as polysyntenic symbolism. And To give you an example of a polysynthetic symbolism, and particularly in terms of the scaphological tradition, there's a relationship between Self-Effa Watcher, Seraph, which is a serpent, which is a non-human angel, and Serepha, which is fire. A similar relationship is found in the Old Semitic with Erin, which is a watcher or a shining one, or indeed in the Greek, Theos God, Theos a watcher, a phos, which is light. And so we're seeing that there are these synthetic strings and that they correspond morphologically in multiple languages. Now, this I refer to as universal symbolism. This is kind of a universal structure, and this is found within all languages, this universal structure. Now, one of the reasons for this universal structure is, I think, is to do with the actual nature of the universe. I refer to this as syntactic resonance, which is really another word for a morphogenetic field. But this is kind of the information field. And so the universe is, if you like, a grammatical system. It can be the universe is an information field. In the classical world, they refer to this as the logos. I refer to this as syntactic resonance. And so in the universe, basically, the universe can store information. It's structured very much like a fractal. And so we're seeing that the universe is a fractal, or the holographic universe, and an extension of this idea is syntactic resonance, which is this fractal universe, which I refer to as the mirrorverse, because I think the mirrorverse is a really good way of explaining how the universe is a hologram, and in many respects, the implicated order of ideas can be explicated. It can be expressed as a particle, as a physical form, and in quantum physics, this would relate to the waveform duality, so the relationship between the waveform and the particle. So the universe is, if you like, this information field, and it's created from these holographic plates. I refer to this as tectonic holography. Tectonic holography are these holographic plates, but there's a relationship here with a seismic pattern, and the seismic pattern is very important. It's important in terms of paratopological states, which are these alternative dimensions. And so earthquakes are very important in relationship to the opening of portals, and this relates to the holographic nature of reality. And we have circumstantial evidence to suggest that aliens are monitoring earthquakes. And there's a number of reasons for this. One is that earthquakes seem to be equated with the opening of these paratopological states, which are these alternative dimensions. And if we think of the universe as multiple holographic plates, which is this information field, the entities are monitoring this. But also, this relates to something which I refer to as sign language. Now, sign language is spelled S-I-N-E, but obviously is connected to a sign. Now, sign language is this sine wave, and these entities communicate using sign language, which again is very closely related to what I refer to as the earthquake signal, which are these separate tectonic holographic plates, as I said before. So there's a close relationship between telepathy, but also this close relationship with language and linguistics. And so trying to get your head around, if you like, the fabric of space or even the biology of space, which is this information field, it has very much strong connotations, both for the representation of telepathic language and in terms of how that signal is translated. It has implications in terms of communicating with non-local consciousness, which also includes physical entities. And sort of the premise of the book, it's a little bit hard to describe because I'm again, first of all, this is the first time that I've been talking about this, and these are very complicated ideas, and I'm still trying to process a lot of the information myself and present it in a way which is accessible to the audience. But yeah, that's, if you like, a summary, a quick summary of the book. If you've got any questions, please feel free. Maybe we can tease out some of the terminology, and maybe I can give you some specific examples.
Yes, there's a few terms I'd like some elaboration.
Yes, okay. There are a number of things which I mean to a reality collapse. I mean it in a literal sense, in a metaphysical sense, in terms of the collapse of the hologram, which arguably is the collapse of the simulation. And again, we can approach reality in a number of different ways. We could say that reality is a simulation, but again, perhaps we could just say that a simulation is a useful metaphor for describing reality. So that, if you like, there are two schools of thought. I'm kind of more of the inclination that the simulation is a useful metaphor. And again, I think we've got to be very careful about tripping up over language. So there's a metaphysical collapse of a reality collapse, because these entities can control these paratopological states. But also there's a psychological reality collapse as well for the individual who is experiencing something which is beyond their comprehension. And again, with the merging together of these semi-permeable, I describe them as paratopological membranes. So if you think of different realities, different vibrating frequencies, you can draw in these frequencies into coherence basically through sound. Pythagoras alluded to this in his research in terms of the Pythagorean monochord, which is this single string. The bass notes is matter, and as the vibration increases, then this goes into the spirit realm. Now, entities are aware of sound and manipulate sound in terms of to change their physical structure so that they can walk through walls. Now, obviously, there's some argument about whether they're doing this technologically or whether they're non-physical entities. My understanding of this, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and this actually ties into my idea on the unified theory of ufology, is that we have two groups or two separate groups of entities. So the first group of entities are a holographic culture, and a holographic culture, they're physical extraterrestrials, and they've deconstructed the mechanics of waveform reality. And this really means that they've interpenetrated space, but also the spiritual realm of ideas. And then in comparison or in conjunction, we have, if you like, inorganic entities. Now, I refer to this as an information field, but it's more than an information field, because it's an aggregate, and it's an aggregate which can individuate and manifest. And even the evidence is that this can materialize in a physical sense. So, and this interlinks with plasma, and very much it links very possibly to the representation of the jinn. So we have, if you like, these two realms or two realities, and in the middle, we intersect in the middle. So we have holographic cultures, which are physical entities, which have deconstructed the physical parameters of reality. And in combination, we have this information field, or this imprinting of this information field, which can individuate and is this aggregate, this information code. And again, this information code links into the imaginal realm of ideas, in which Plato referred to as the universal forms or universal ideas. So this is, you know, in the New Age, this would be the Akashi records, but it goes back very much into Platonic ideas of universal forms. And this is a plasma field, okay? So the evidence is from the latest research, and I'm quoting research now from Professor Temple and Professor Wickramasinghe. They wrote a paper, and they argued that plasma could be the most intelligent life form. And this intelligent life form is it's combined, if you like, of plasma, but the plasma as crystals. And it's believed that these crystals act very much like neurons. And I believe that the crystals, and again, this is a speculative to a degree, but I think it connects with some of the evidence that we have, is that plasma is able to somehow assimilate itself into the human host, and with these nanocrystals is able to communicate. Now, plasma is interesting at a number of reasons. One reason is that our bones actually create plasma, and I believe that in terms of the spiritual record, that human beings, that the soul pattern is imprinted in plasma. And so there is this close connection between, shall we say, non-human entities and the soul pattern, and how this imprints within plasma in a way which is not really fully understood. But it's really important to understanding the physical dimension of extraterrestrials. And I refer to this corroboration because I believe that there is a corroboration between physical extraterrestrials and these non-organic entities as the somnumatic collective. Now, somnum means body and pneuma is the spirit. So there's this collective which are working together and are working in unison. Now, obviously, within the ufological and scaphological tradition, the difficulty then is, and particularly because we are dealing here with entities that can intrude within the human mind, is how to, shall we say, differentiate between a being which is shall we say, non-physical but can materialize physical and an actual physical extraterrestrial being. And this complexity, I think, is one of the difficulties in terms of how we differentiate what is happening. I think we need to be very much aware that this phenomenon is a multi-agency or a multimodal thing which we're looking at. It's an aspect which materializes in different ways. And so being aware of this, I think, is very important in terms of deconstructing the ufological tradition, because I made this reference in holographic culture. I referred to this as the alien dialectic. So basically, the alien dialectic is that, and this is what ufologists have been arguing about for a long time. And really, the answer is very simple, because we're looking at two. It's almost like a spectrum, but we're looking at two sides of the same coin. So Sark, which is the flesh, is very much connected into Psyche, which is the spirit. The flesh and the spirit are cognates, and they're very closely aligned in the same way that wave-particle duality is aligned. The particulation of form is the particle, and the universe, which is, if you like, manifesting from the implicated realm. The implication from that is that physical life materializes from the realm of ideas or the immaterial realm. This is what I was referring to earlier in terms of the biology of space. So, yeah, this is this leads into how we actually deconstruct what we're looking at, because obviously both types of entities, whether it's physical or whether we're dealing with angelic sailors and physical entities or physical extraterrestrials, are able to intrude themselves into our mind. In addition, to complicate the matters, it seems that physical extraterrestrial races are using plasma very likely as a type of AI, because it can store information. So they would be using this as a type of very sophisticated computing system, and they may be utilizing plasma also in terms of a type of satellite technology as well, in terms of interacting with humans, and again possibly also impregnating them with these type of nano neurotransmitters. And again, I'm speculating here, but this is based upon evidence within the ufological tradition and within the fairy tradition and folklore as well. So, yeah, I don't know. Have you got any questions?
Just a quick comment about the plasma and the plasma being a living organism. That does make sense because we live in a plasma electric universe, and plasma has been likened to people who have studied it, that there seems to be like a biological aspect to it in relation to when people study molecular biology or whatever the case may be, that there's some connection there. And also, you were talking about earthquakes and influence of the sun and alien interest in seismic activity. But we know they fly in and out of volcanoes, like the big one in Mexico or near Mexico City. But I'm reminded of a big earthquake I was a part of in 1989. We were hit with what I call earthquake weather, or what they call in California earthquake weather. I was telling people, this is weird. There's something strange going on in the hours leading up to it. You couldn't even hear a bird chirp. You couldn't even hear an insect chirp. We were like in a vacuum stillness leading up to the hours of this big earthquake. If that earthquake lasted another 5 or 10 seconds, I wouldn't be here. So thank you for bringing that up. And you had some other terms that you referred to, one of which I find fascinating, a paradox switch. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, okay. In my book, I look at three paradox switches. And I mean, a paradox switch at the basic level is just another term for a reality collapse. But the paradox switch, there are three paradox switches. So the first one is the witness paradox. And the witness paradox refers to, well, let's say two people will say, perhaps see an entity or something like that, and they experience what is ostensibly similar, but they may report facts which are quite different. I'm reminded of my friend Paul Sinclair. He details an account where he's walking on the cliffs with his friend, and he sees a red orb which is floating, a shining orb, but his friend said that it looked like a square and it was structured. When you look at folklore accounts and ufological accounts, this actually occurs quite a lot. And some of this, and I'm not obviously, witnesses can report things differently, and they can interpret things differently. And there could be all kinds of different reasons for this, such as being short-sighted, etc. But I do think in some cases that this is to do with electromagnetic fields and how electromagnetic fields affects the brain. and particularly the relationship between language and memory. So that's the first paradox switch. And then the paradox switch is this switch or collapse in reality, this reality collapse. And again, this reality collapse can happen as a person enters a paratopological state, which is this, if you like, this controlled environment. Now, the paratopological state typically, and it's very interesting what you were saying about earthquakes, and this would actually make sense. Typically, there's a reduction within the audioscape. And so typically when people see fairies or when they communicate with extraterrestrial entities, or even if they see plasma as well, there's a reduction in the soundscape. Now, the reason for this is that there seems to be a cancelling of sound waves. And so if you have a sound wave front and another sound wave front and they're of a similar level, they cancel each other out. And this leads to a reduction in sound. And this is so pervasive throughout ufology. So we have this cancellation of sound waves, which is very indicative of a paratopological state. Now, a paratopological state refers to a number of ideas. First, it refers to the osmosis of worlds and these semi-permeable membranes, which basically can melt into each other. If you like, the a sound level, two worlds are coming into the same vibration. They're at the same consonance. And so this would refer to an heterodyne portal or heterodynamic portal in which these entities can come through. These portals do seem to be related to tectonic activity. And as I suggested earlier, that there's a metaphysical interpretation to this in terms of the holographic nature of the universe, and even in terms of the simulatory level of the universe. As I mentioned, this interconnects to sign language, which are sine waves or telepathy, and is closely concordant with the fractal ordering of language. So languages or universal structure are arranged according to these syntonic strings, and this relates to this syntactic resonance or this vibration, which is part of the information code. So they're all very closely entwined together. What we're dealing here really is a type of information pattern, and accessing the information pattern is basically accessing different dimensions. It's linked into telepathy, and it's also linked into accessing basically all information, because all information is stored within space. Professor Vopson makes the same types of implications himself in terms of his research. He argues that information, it doesn't deteriorate. It's not it's not like, shall we say, the physical world, but even the deterioration of the physical world, you know, mass is converted into energy. And so what we're seeing is just basically this continuation, the continuation of the information pattern, which links into plasma, it links into the soul pattern. So that's sort of some of the ideas which are found within holographic culture. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you've got any ideas or...
Yes, you mentioned that this notion of the silence, this pervasive silence, which occurs in close proximity to either a craft, an orb, or some kind of a being, that has been described many times in the field. And I've even heard stories from people, and I have no reason to doubt them. I've heard this from a number of people, that some of the ETs not only have shipborne equipment or a technology that allows them to put everyone and everything into a freeze frame mode, not only a vacuum stillness, but freeze everybody in place. And also, these reptilians in human guise had taken this one individual I know into a busy restaurant, and they activated a handheld device. Everyone froze in the midst of what they were doing, talking, eating, chewing, whatever the case may be. It was an object lesson of how much they were able to control time and space in a given localized area, right? And then if you scale it up, well, what else can they do? Can they do this in more than just a specific location? So I think what you described there, converting it into an alien abduction perspective, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I refer to this in Angelic Invasion as temporal editing. So they are able to edit time. We certainly have a case in the 1970s, I think it was 1974, the Igdon case. He came across these entities, and he was hunting elk, and he shot his rifle, and the bullet, he could see the bullet going through the air very slowly, and it hit something, and it made a splat noise, again, which is indicative of this heterodyne dynamic field, this soundscape, which is very silent, it's very quiet. It's almost like I guess it's similar to snow. If there's a lot of snow, that tends to dampen the sound and it makes things very quiet. But typically, you don't hear anything. There's no birds, there's no insects, it's just very eerie and it's very silent. And I mean, in combination with these heterodynamic fields, there is often trying to think. I was going to say something there, but yes, this synthetic emotion which can be overlaid as well. So, for example, within these paratopological states, sometimes overlaid with the paratopological state would be a certain type of emotion, such as fear or something like this. And again, this might be to keep people away from a particular area. And we see that entities also communicate using synthetic emotion. And this is really important because telepathy is this multi-layered way of communication, and it can communicate it's a very tactile, it can communicate sensory information, visual information, smell, taste, and it can also communicate emotion. And I believe that the entities use emotion as a means of communication. And typically they would augment a command with a type of emotion in order to really reinforce the communication, to really accentuate and make that communication powerful. Typically the entities will often issue a command as like, "Don't look at me." This is quite common, and that is often suffused with, let's say, a feeling of anger. And so typically if a human being feels anger, just typically the response is to look away, to shun. I think one of the reasons why the entities don't like humans looking at them is to do with telepathy, because telepathy is not just one way. It's this transmission of information, and it goes both ways. But this is something which I look at in terms of angelic invasion. I look at this idea of psychic mirroring. So this is inadvertent telepathic imprinting, where a person may pick up on a telepathic signal and act out something as a result of the entity. In the Philip and Ronald Kinsella, they're identical twins. In this case, Philip Kinsella, when this entity, it basically bent the glass. So again, we're seeing this kind of technology which can move electrons in a way. And again, I think this is closely related to the earthquake signal. And indeed, his twin brother went into this trance and he said, "There's an earthquake and Grandma's going to die." This is, if you like, the earthquake signal, which is related to this translocation of this entity through this door, through some type of molecular synthesizer. And so, yeah, we do see that, yeah. And sorry, I'm kind of losing my track of thought there, but yeah, if you've got anything to add to that, I'm sure what I was thinking of is going to come back again.
It speaks to the ability of some of these beings, at least some of these civilizations, to be able to affect what mainstream scientists call the fabric of space and time in ways we don't quite understand. Their ability to move through solid objects, the ability to make abductees that they're taking move through solid objects when they're abducting them, what have you. So they have an understanding of frequency, density, resonance that we don't quite, at least in the mainstream sense, don't quite understand. So, your information is invaluable because it helps to break this down, deconstruct it on the etymological basis. One of the other terms that you were utilizing, the concept of a psychotropolis, a city of the mind. Could you talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah. Okay. So basically, as we mentioned before, with the induction of a paratopological state, which is typically a type of heterodynamic portal or the merging or osmosis of worlds, but with the psychotropolis, we often see also that they control the psychological environment of the mind and they communicate through the mind. And typically they communicate through the mind using ideas and a visual stimulus. But again, they can use the mind and manipulate the mind. And so certainly in cases of abduction, we'll see many cases of where, so for example, within the ancient world, the satyrs were said to put people into stupors or to put them into this trance-like state. Again, the etymology of satyr, although from the Greek, it's really coming from the Arabic etymology, satyr, which is to hide, cover, or conceal. And again, This is because this closely is concordant with the traditions of the jinn. So a satyr is represented as a goat, and the goat is used to represent a type of jinn because the etymology of jinn is related in the Arabic to janna, which is to hide or to conceal. And this is really the concealment of the occult tradition. Occult means to conceal. And as we can see, there's an etymological connection with occult and ocular, or the eye. And this is because the eye refers to the watcher, sopher for watcher, a seraph, a serpent, serepha, which is fire, which is another word for a jinn, or those who are born from smokeless fire. The word seraph is typically translated as a jinn. And the seraphim are concordant with Sirius, the shining star Sirius. Sara, which is a spark in Arabic, relates to Sira, which is Sirius. And so the flame or fire is used to denote Sirius, the flaming one, the shining one, in Greek, Sirios, which is the scorching one. So these are all fire signifiers which relate to the seraphim. The seraphim are typically represented as watchers. So, in the Apocrypha traditions, Amram, who is Moses' father, talks to one of the watchers, and it states that the watcher had the face of a viper. So, these watchers are they're dragon-like or seraphic in their appearance. And again, the etymology of drakon in the Greek is related to drakos, which is eye, drakein, which is to watch. Again, the seraphim and the dragon are concordant with the worship of the deities as well. So we see in Greek, for example, and this is a polysynthetic string, so this is a synthetic string which translates into another language. So Theos, a god, and Theos, a watcher, is equated in Aramaic with which is a watcher. And so I'm just trying to remember what I was trying to say there. Sopher for watcher, seraph a serpent. Yes, but it's Theos, a god, Theos, a watcher in the Greek. And it cross translates. So we've got seraph and sopher, which is a watcher, which is a type of seraphim. So yeah, these entities and these wordplays are found throughout multiple languages. I refer to, if you like, the alien code, which is encoded within human language, as the artifact. That's something which I touch upon in my book, Holographic Culture, this idea that we can find this invisible operative encoded in human languages. And this is universal. It's not just found within one language. It's found in multiple languages, and it's encoded in these polysynthetic strings, which, as I've adverted to before, actually reveals this universal structure, this universal code, which is has cosmological implications, both in terms of the holographic nature of reality and in terms of how the language is like a fractal. It's ordered like a fractal. So this is something we need to be mindful of. And as I've suggested, this interlinks with them in very profoundly in terms of metaphysics and how this relates to these entities and their understanding of time and space and their manipulation of this universal structure or this implicated realm, this realm of ideas, this spiritual realm. And I'm sure you've come across this yourself in terms of the ufological tradition, that there is this spiritual component where in near-death experience, aliens or non-human entities are often seen. And this is something which was documented in Professor Ring's work in terms of near-death experience. So, and this would make sense in terms of my idea regarding the unified theory of ufology, which the idea that there is this subnomadic collective with these physical extraterrestrial entities, but they have this spirit technology. And they understand the imprinting of the soul pattern. They understand the relationship of plasma and how plasma can store information. I believe that they use this in their own databases and in their own computers. They use plasma, and plasma is intelligent. I believe it can individuate. I think that there's good evidence to suggest it can individuate and it can materialize physically. I think the question is also, if plasma is this universal pervasive consciousness, which is like this supercomputer beyond all dreams, and plasma has the basic building blocks or the basic chemical components, does this mean that plasma can actually, that it's also technological, that it can create physical technology? It could perhaps create a human being, a genetic perfect simile of a human being. I think these are ideas which need to be explored further. And although they may sound very far out, as what you said, we're dealing here with very advanced technologies and very advanced understanding of what we define and what we mean by space, which is much more like a living system, a living ecosystem.
The key concepts, because one thing that plasma physicists note, and especially as it relates to stellar and galactic formation, is that what is seen in the plasma physics labs can be scaled up. It's scale invariant. You can see what's in the lab played out in real time in stellar galactic formation, universal indeed. So it makes sense that the plasma field would be somehow, might as well be connected with the information field. And there's also a fractal aspect to it as well, because if it's scale invariant, if you see a small sample of it played out on a galactic universal scale, and potentially all the information in the information field can be contained within a small fractal of it, well, that would explain a lot. Also, the footage from the SOHO, the solar heliospheric satellite that observes the sun, we're constantly seeing gigantic ships, planet size and bigger, not just spherical ships, but irregularly shaped, very odd looking constructs, but gigantic. Literally, it's sometimes drawing plasma into it from the sun. So clearly, they have a way of assimilating that power source, because the sun is, stars in general are dynamos, essentially plasma dynamos. So I think those are all key concepts. I think it would be a good time to take a break right now. We've had a very fascinating discussion. Could you tell our listeners and viewers where they can find your work and your books, Pierre?
My work can be found at Pierre Sabbagh Books. If you just type that in as one word, then that should come up somewhere at the top of the page. If you just put in my name, Pierre Sabbagh, and you want to find my work, you'll have to go further down the page. It might be on second or third page to find my website. And my website has a picture of me, so it's pretty clear that it's my website. And I'm the only person who sells my books. I don't sell them on Amazon. I just sell them privately. So if you want to get a signed book, then please go to my website, Pierre Sabbagh Books. Thank you.
And to your listeners and viewers out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.